Anchored is a production of the Classic Learning Test. Based in Annapolis, Maryland, reconnecting knowledge and virtue through meaningful assessments. Visit us at cltexam.com/get-started. Today's episode of Anchored is brought to you with support from America's Christian Credit Union. Find out how ACCU can be the banking partner to your school or family by visiting americaschristiancu.com/clt.
Anchored fans, welcome back to the Anchored podcast. I am in beautiful Providence, Rhode Island today at Providence College, and I'm here with Father Jordan Zajac, Dominican priest, who is also a specialist in Shakespeare, early modern English literature, religion, and literature. Maybe has more formal education than anyone I've seen on the Anchored podcast. Pretty amazing. Father, thanks so much for being with us.
Jeremy, it is a pleasure to be with you and all the listeners. And the Lord keeps me humble, though. I'm a kind of a simplex Thomist. You know, simplex priests from the old rite. I'm sort of a simplex Thomist. You know, I know just enough to be dangerous.
That's great. I think in addition to Father or Monsignor Shea, I think Father Jordan, you are the second priest on the Anchored podcast. So welcome as well. I love the presence of the Dominicans on campus here, 40 Dominicans, which is amazing. Father, we'd love to start off, as we often do, your journey both into the priesthood and kind of your early academic formation as well. What was schooling like for you as a young child? Did you imagine yourself as a priest, even as a young boy going to Mass?
Yeah. Catholic school education, right from preschool onwards. I'm the son of a very holy and devout couple. And I'm so grateful to God for that and their witness of my mom and dad. So Catholic school education from preschool on. But of course, I grew up in New Bedford, Massachusetts in the 80s and 90s, which means a cultural Catholic.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, a lot of still some felt banners and things like that. And some good old fashioned kind of like Christian moralism was like, you know, why do you love God? Because so you don't go to hell. Right. Uh-huh. So it took time for me in high school and college and beyond to, you know, develop a more mature faith and understanding of God. But you know, Catholic education from the beginning, and was an altar server from third grade on. And so I became very familiar with life at the altar and by the altar. Mm-hmm. And so I think even, you know, in high school, I could see the priesthood as something eventually that I'd be interested in. But it was only years later. You know, Providence is more than the name of this college. Providence is more than the name of this city. It's a name of God, his loving plan for us in our lives. And he allowed me, as he does with many of his beloved, to kind of forge my own path. Mm-hmm. And he gave me these natural loves and desires, one for English literature, so that by the time I came to Providence College as a student, you know, I had fallen in love with the life of the mind, mm-hmm. the academic life, and especially with Shakespeare and literature.
Okay.
And so by the time, you know, I entered Providence College thinking maybe seminary at some point, and I graduated thinking I want the tweed jacket and the pipe and the elbow patches, and I want to be a Shakespearean at some small liberal arts college, and ideally in New England.
Uh-huh.
And so I embarked on that path instead. And so I went to the University of Virginia for my master's degree.
Nice, yeah.
Had an incredible experience down there on Mr. Jefferson's grounds. And then from there, went to the University of Massachusetts Amherst for my doctorate in Shakespearean drama. And it was there in, I dare say, godless Amherst that's where the Lord, that's where he truly drew me.
Wow. Okay.
To the
okay.
priesthood.
What year were you ordained?
I was ordained in 2020.
Okay.
Under lockdown.
Wow.
So I was already here. I was doing a pastoral year here as a deacon in preparation to be a full-time professor, just to get to know the culture again and this generation of students, unique as they are. And so lockdown meant, you know, ordination in place. So all my classmates were ordained down in Washington, D.C. It's right here on campus.
Okay.
First Dominican friar in over 100 years of the campus to ever be ordained priest here on campus.
Wow.
So wow. It was a blessing.
Now, as a convert to Catholicism in 2010, I'm always amazed when I meet folks who were cradle Catholics in the 80s and 90s, which perhaps in the history of the church may have been the worst decades ever for catechesis. And so it's kind of a miracle when you meet Catholics who grew up in the church during that time and they love Jesus and they love the church. So, Father, about half of our audience is not Catholic. Many Christians who love the classical tradition, I think, have a respect for the Catholic intellectual tradition, but maybe don't get kind of the order thing, the different orders. If folks have never really heard much at all about Dominicans, talk to us about the role of Dominicans within the Catholic Church.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a great question. You know, even if we just take a step back and like, what are all these religious orders or these groups where it's like they're different teams in the same league, they got different colors, but it's all kind of old fashioned garb, what's going on there?
Yeah.
Throughout the life and times of the church, there are specific peoples and places and needs. And the Lord puts in the history of the church, saints ordinarily in contact with those people and places in particular needs. Mother Teresa is there in Calcutta and she sees one leper, you know, she sees one ill person in the streets. She cares for them. She continues to do it. Other women are inspired by that. They're drawn to her way of life and very naturally and organically to fit the times and the needs of a particular place and time. The Lord gives these charisms, these graces to bring people together in a way of life where we take these vows, poverty, chastity, obedience, and live in a radical kind of gospel way. For the Dominicans, it was 800 years ago in the midst of just as we are kind of an intellectual crisis and confusion now, so too in the Middle Ages, just as in the life of the church right now, we're struggling in the wake of you know terrible scandals. So too, there were many disedifying examples in the church in the Middle Ages, 12th century, 13th century. And it was there that, you know, not only St. Dominic, but also St. Francis, they were contemporaries. You know, they wanted to live. They saw the errors of members of the church, clergy especially, and they felt called to live in a more authentically, radically, you know, Catholic, Catholic way and clerical way. So, well, at least for St. Dominic. So he was already a priest and, you know, he's out, long story short, he finds himself in southern France on a journey and all these people that have been drawn away from the faith. And he finds himself preaching to them, trying to teach them.
Okay.
Those who had, you know, it's almost like they're inoculated against the gospel because they grew up with it.
Yeah.
And he starts to have success and he draws other men to himself. And this order of preachers develops in the 13th century where we're preachers and teachers were kind of everyone was it was a radical form of life in the church. People knew monks. You leave the world, you join a monastery, you pray to God, you contemplate, and you know you have an intellectual life, but that it stays in the monastery. These are like monks that are busting out out under the streets because everyone needs it. Everyone needs that saving message. Mm-hmm. And you know at the beginning, people are like, what are these monks doing running around? But it's became a very attractive way of life. Our most famous saint other than St. Dominic is St. Thomas Aquinas. If Dominic is our spiritual father, then Thomas is sort of our intellectual father. Mm. I mean, we're all shaped by the thought of Aquinas. Dominic sent the brethren out two by two and went to university cities.
Okay.
You know, anywhere and everywhere they could. And so we've always had a great impact on the scholarly tradition and university systems in Europe and now in the United States here.
Okay. Tell us a bit about the origins of Providence College. I believe the first Catholic university in America was Georgetown. You know, you think of schools like Harvard and Yale and Princeton that have these Puritan roots. And, you know, we've seen the mission drift there. We'll get into that in just a few minutes. But tell us first, if you would, about the Dominicans establishing. What year was this? What was the context?
Absolutely. The year was 1917. And our roots, the Dominican roots in the United States, go back to the 19th century. The first Dominicans arrived just after the Jesuits. And they will go to Washington, D.C., and they appeal to the bishop and say, we'd love to found a college or a university. He says, you know, I just told these Jesuits they could found this place called Georgetown. We have all these Catholics that are out in Kentucky, Ohio, that are migrating out that way for opportunities, and they have no priests to minister to them. So would you go out that way? And that's where the Dominicans started in Kentucky, Ohio. We were the first bishop of Ohio out there. And then we eventually make our way back east, end up in major cities like Boston and New York. And in 1917, seeing the needs of the church in New England at that time, where both Catholics and Jewish people were not being allowed into, you know, some of those other institutions, it was like we've got to find a school for Catholic immigrants and others who are not given the same educational opportunities. And so that was the founding mission and ethos for PC.
Okay, fantastic. Now, many of the CLT students base, many are homeschooled. They're doing Mother Divine Grace or Colby or Seton. Many go to schools like the Chesterton Academies, which are growing rapidly. Love that. Tell us a little bit, if you would, about kind of the Catholic identity of Providence College. Many of our students, when we talk to families, they're looking at places like Thomas Aquinas College, Franciscan, Belmont Abbey, Benedictine. For families looking for a faithfully Catholic college or university, is PC a good fit?
Yeah, it's a great question. I get it all the time because so many of the people that are listening to this podcast or the kinds of people that are listening to this podcast are the ones that are in the parishes and other ministries that we have in the Eastern province of St. Joseph here. And it's a great question. And it's one of the things that makes me happiest about being a Dominican here and now in this province at this age, because it is such a crucial moment. And I'll be honest, just as we are living in an apostolic age, so too the Dominicans are an apostolic order. We see what the apostles did and we're trying to do the same thing. We need that to happen, and we embrace the fact that we need to make it happen on campus just as much as in the culture. And so it is absolutely possible to find and receive and be nourished by an authentically Catholic education here at Providence College, but it is not a bubble. It's not a nest. It's preparation, I would say, for the real world, but it's more like the rat race out there, because what we see out in the mainstream culture is not the real. It's not real enough. Yeah. And so we're trying to give our students an education that prepares them for, so many different experiences they're going to have in their life and encounters with those who don't know the faith, who are hostile to the faith.
Yeah.
So it's about, we're fighting daily for the soul of the campus, just as we are for the soul of the culture. And we're making great inroads because we're being blessed. The Dominicans and the province of St. Joseph, the kind of region that operates and oversees this college, the province is being blessed with a number of vocations where other communities and dioceses are seeing very few ordinations, if any. We're ordaining 8, 10, 12 men to the priesthood every year, a lot of them with higher degrees, or they go on for doctorates, and we're kind of flooding the campus. There's, as you said, close to 40 of us here right now. And so it's, the future of Providence College, it's only going in one direction. Mm-hmm. And it's becoming more and more robustly Catholic. And we have, and just faithful to the, humanistic tradition.
Right? Yeah.
Because just anecdotally, for me as an English professor, there are, a number of students who end up at Providence College, not because they see, there are crucifixes all over the place, and we have mass, daily mass 3 times a day, and confessions available and holy hours every day. Mm-hmm. They're not here for that. They're here for other reasons, and they come from the world and they're of the world. But then they take a Shakespeare course with me, and it's not just a course on Shakespeare's histories and comedies. I tell them this is a course on friendship. All right, we're going to look at this core aspect of our reality, and we're going to explore the way Shakespeare dramatizes it and the impact that can have on the way we think about it in our lives. So let me give you some classic examples. And, I've got these, some of them pretty progressive students, and we're reading, all right, let's look at Seneca. Let's look at Aristotle. Here are the classics. Shakespeare would have known them and received them in the tradition, even somebody funky like Montaigne, but some really, him on friendship still. But then, all right, let's apply that to, and then let's look at courtship. Romantic love is an extension of friendship. And let's see how it plays out on the stage and in Shakespeare's imaginary. And what impact does it have on the way that you approach something so fundamental? Because, no matter what the background, education, at least in my experience here so far at PC, I find that's one of the biggest things young people today struggle with, is just understanding and trying to find authentic friendships and relationships with peers. And so this, in the classroom, we try to cultivate, habits of of mind and hopefully then correspond to actions and findings with others.
You know, I think as our audience tries to think through Providence College, I think there's a comparison with University of Mary. I went out there in early March in a record snow season for Bismarck, North Dakota, and did a podcast there with Monsignor Shea. And I met two kinds of students. I met a couple of students from California, and because of Monsignor Shea, because of the Catholic culture, they went to North Dakota for 4 years for college. But I met other students who said they came just because the nursing program is amazing, or they came because, you know, the hockey is incredible, and they weren't thinking about that. They weren't considering their faith, but they had a transformative experience when they were there, which is incredible. One of the things you told me offline, which I think is just amazing, is you actually have 30, 40, 50 students every year who are getting confirmed, new baptism, students who may come here and they're not Catholic at all, but through the witness of the Dominicans are being introduced to the faith. Can you speak more about that?
Yeah, absolutely. Through the witness of the Dominicans and also of the contingency of a very strong, intentional Catholic lay faculty that we have here. A lot of them kind of concentrated in what's called the humanities program. And we like to go, it's kind of contrary to the Benedict option or those who would say, all right, let's retreat from the world. We're out there, both Dominicans and lay faculty and staff, to try to just be leaven in the culture. Mm-hmm. So we'll find students wherever they're at, we'll meet them wherever they're at and try to bring them higher, bring them closer to the truth and the love of Christ. And we have great success. There is our signature program is called the Development of Western Civilization.
I'm such a fan. And when I visited for the first time in 2016, I'm like, how do more people not know about this? Because we've talked about this extensively on the Anchor podcast. You know, we really have seen half a century now of college and university, one after another, just trashing any kind of a serious core curriculum. Right. PC has not done that at all.
No.
And tell us about the foundations in Western Civ here.
Yeah, we've doubled down on this and invested in it. So it's an interdisciplinary, integrated approach to the humanities. It's the core of the Providence College education. Every student is required to take it. It's 4 semesters, 4 credits a semester, interdisciplinary. So it's history, theology, philosophy, and literature professors. And we begin at the beginnings in the ancient world and through a 4-semester sequence, or it's a 3-semester historical sequence, going through the greatest hits of the Western tradition, looking at it from every angle, historically, philosophically, theologically, and from the literary. And then it culminates with a 4th semester where they have students can pick a colloquium, a kind of special topics course, where they can decide, do I want to look at the history of sports? Do I want to look at, I co-teach a course on C.S. Lewis as a Christian thinker, his literature and theology, or you know, we might look at Europe in between the wars. So you get to have this kind of signature at the end of the experience there. And so many students, this is not for most listeners for the podcast here, but for so many students that coming from the secular culture, this is the first time they've ever encountered the confessions or the Divine Comedy or a lot of these just core texts that I would argue if you haven't read these, then you can't call yourself literate. And grace is real. They're transformed by that grace. Their minds and hearts are opened and they start to seek. And that's where the rest of us Dominicans and other faithful faculty members here, the conversations after class lead to encouraging them to go to the chapel to pray and just seek God. And then they are doing these programs or these other experiences. I just saw a student yesterday who's here for the summer working on campus. At the end of the semester, this in May, he went on a program through the humanities program over to Rome for 3 weeks.
Okay.
And he's describing to me how he's in this cathedral and he's looking at this one depiction of Our Lady, the Virgin Child. And he said, Father, I must have stared at that thing for an hour because it became so real. It was like they were looking at me and breathing. Wow. They were living and breathing. And Father, what are there masses available this summer? That's at least the next question. So there's a lot of inroads to grace. Yeah.
Let's talk about Shakespeare. You are a Shakespeare scholar. Shakespeare has been one of many of the dead white men being debated right now. And there was an article that I believe was in the New York Times, a teacher saying, hey, how can my students, relate to Shakespeare? But in the debate, I think some folks have walked away realizing and appreciating Shakespeare more than ever. Give us, if you would, a little bit of the context first of Shakespeare's life and kind of early influence, I guess, beginning in the 17th century.
Absolutely. This is one of the ways I start to knock at the idol that is the bard and knock him off the pedestal and just make him more real for students. Mm-hmm. We start by describing what early modern London looked like and smelled like and everything. And the place that the theaters had, the commercial theaters. So this is a brand new kind of entertainment enterprise that, you know, Shakespeare and others is the first generation where they're like, we can just make money. These medieval pageant plays and things that we take on carts around for festivals, we can just keep this in one theater and people will come to us. Mm. And it's in like basically the red light district of these cities, or it's outside the city walls. You are walking to the theater, and you know there's going to be some form of entertainment there in the afternoon. It might be Hamlet, or it might be bear baiting, where you're gambling on whether, you know, a bear that's chained to a stick can fight off and defeat these dogs, or the dogs are going to beat him to death. And it's like, this is popular culture. This is not, let's get dressed up and go to the theater and just sit there passively as we revere it now. It's worthy of reverence, but it's for everybody. Everybody went, everyone got something out of it. Mm-hmm. So what is that? What is that? And I think Shakespeare in particular, and I also teach courses on his contemporaries, Christopher Marlowe, Ben Jonson, others are good, but they're always like, yeah, this is good, Father, but it's not, well, Shakespeare would have done something more. It's like, yep, it's an insight from another Shakespearean at Catholic University of America, Michael Mack. You know, he says, if Shakespeare had been a physician, if he'd gone to medical school, he would have been a pathologist. What he in this sense, like a moral pathologist, like he loves to show us what's real. Morally compromised characters in compromised or difficult situations, making incredibly challenging choices. Mm. And any one of us who, you know, knows what that's like, sees this and learns and gains valuable things from it, from this inquiry and it's revelatory. I think all good literature it reveals something to us that we didn't know or we've experienced, but don't have can articulate for ourselves otherwise.
Well, one of the classical schools, I think a hallmark of these new schools is there's a deep love for theater. You tour these schools and they're always advertising, you know, their next play they're putting on together. Is theater a part of the life at Providence College?
We have a theater, dance, and film department. They're always they will put on multiple productions every year. And it's the kind of space where, again, I love it. It's not just that, you know, the drama majors come in and they rule the roost. One of my students from his freshman year in that development Western Civ course, just a very thoughtful and kind of goofy guy. He walks on. He auditions for the role of Macbeth and gets it. And he was phenomenal. And I see him on campus now and I'm like, you kind of scare me. I think you're going to like thrust me through the, you know, I'm going to be the Duncan to your Macbeth here. Because he was so compelling and so good. So yeah, drama is one of those embodied art forms that you know, brings just the whole of one's humanity into play. There are a lot of students that enjoy acting, and whenever they have a show on, it's always sold out every weekend.
Okay. Yep. What are the current Shakespeare books you teach?
The current Shakespeare, what I'd like to do, we have two courses, tragedies and the romances, and then the histories and the comedies. And I love to give them a smattering. I don't want to bore your audience to death, but I'd love to give them a smattering of different literary theories and critics who approach, whether it's everything from Christian humanism, a Christian humanistic approach to Shakespeare, to a cultural Marxist approach. Mm. And it's like the idea there is, you know, students discover for themselves that ideologies are not very life-giving. So I'll give them a smattering of literary critics and theorists and stuff like that to supplement. Okay, here's a feminist reading of A Midsummer Night's Dream. And here is what a recent scholar, Lee Ozer, up at Holy Cross, here's how he approaches it in his book, Christian Humanism and Shakespeare. And all right, you discuss. What'd you get out of these readings? So I'll do that. And then I also love to give them, again, one of the things that with Shakespeare, there isn't one Shakespeare, or at least he's seized upon and tries to be co-opted by so many different kinds of groups. I'll give them different biographies of the bard. There's a new one that just came out this year that I haven't read it yet, but I'm like, it came through the Arden Shakespeare. So it's you know, legitimate press. And let's give him that and see, let's see what this guy does with the historical record, and who does he want to craft Shakespeare into? You know, what are his interests and values? Because we impose so much, and that's through the history of Shakespearean reception. You see that. The number one question I get is, was Shakespeare Catholic? What's going on there?
Interesting.
And the more
so I see the context, he couldn't publicly be Catholic.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct. And there are those who, Joseph Pierce most vociferously says, absolutely, he was Catholic. And here's all the evidence.
Okay.
In the texts. And I admire his zeal, but less so his sort of literary finesse. Because I'm like, if it's that obvious to us now, he would have been, if not beheaded, at least fined. And he's a, you know, he's, he wouldn't, there's also, there's a historian calls it the compliance conundrum. The state sanctioned religion goes back and forth throughout the, you know, the entirety of Shakespeare's life.
Yeah.
And he himself, he's baptized Protestant. He is born 5 or 6 years after Elizabeth takes the, you know, the throne, but his older sister, Joan, baptized Roman Catholic. His parents. Okay. So how do you, there is just a deep sense of, they call it the age of conscience as well. Mm. Like there's the state sanctioned religion, and you follow that unless you want to pay the price. But then there's also the interior of your heart and your private beliefs. And there's a whole another, you know, landscape within there that it was intentionally uninhabitable by anybody else. You know, it's, and they would, there are plenty of other records of those who would be okay, closet Catholics, and you don't realize it until well afterwards.
Wow. Wow. So context here, Shakespeare, what year does Shakespeare die? This is early 1600s.
He is born 1564 and dies in 1616. So he lives through the reigns of Elizabeth the First and then James the First.
Okay.
Yep.
So this is a time where you have the long reign of Elizabeth. You have the Westminster standards, low tolerance, I guess, for being Catholic. Were there masses happening secretly during Shakespeare's age? And
there are Jesuits there in plain clothes in England trying to do what they can to sustain an underground Catholic culture. There are manors and estates, you know, Catholic families that remained faithful. And, you know, they have these things called priest holes. Government officials come to say, you know, hey, we heard you got a priest here and you're doing that mass stuff. There's a little, like a little foxhole. I mean, they're a little hiding. The priest is down there. If you've seen the Bond film Skyfall, he goes to his old estate and it's in Scotland, but and there's the final battle sequence. It's kind of like James Bond does Home Alone. And one of the devices they use is I'm going to hide in the priest hole. Because it was an old Catholic family. So there were those who remained faithful. There are Catholic martyrs in this, in England in this time. There are even, you know, like the Jesuits, Robert Southwell, who's writing about his, you know, The Burning Babe, this mystical poem about what it's like to encounter Christ, especially in the midst of a hostile, you know, a culture that's hostile to the Roman Catholic faith. So they're there and they're present, and it's a very messy and complicated religious, you know, period of religious history, but the Catholics are there.
Yeah. I want to go back, if we could, and kind of press this question a bit. I was so encouraged by your response. You said that Providence College is only going in one direction in terms of Catholic orthodoxy, which is exciting. But the culture and the history of higher ed is that has not been the trend. You know, I think we've seen one institution after another go in a different direction. What is it that makes you optimistic about the future of PC?
Yeah, it begins with, you know, I mentioned this before, as a Dominican, I say it begins with us. All the men that, and again, there are many men being drawn to the order, and it's like, this is the Lord's work, clearly. And we love the church, all of her teachings, all of her truths, and we want to teach the truth in love, and we'll remain faithful to that. If the culture continues to go one direction, even if for some reason the culture on campus continues to go in that direction, you know, we're going to remain resolute, and you know, we would shake the dust from our feet before we let that let that happen. So we'd say this, okay, this is no longer a ministry of province, you know, of the province. If it, you know, we'd take that away. That's not going to happen because, look at rank and file faculty members, you know, Dominicans that are rank and file faculty members and staff members will move to positions of administration. We know what we're about. we know who we're about.
I love on the leadership, you said that Providence will always have a Dominican as mm-hmm. president.
As a president, yep. That's part of the bylaws here. Yep, so okay. we have both. The president is a Dominican, other administrators are, and we also have bishop of the diocese on the mm-hmm. On the corporation. And so we have a new bishop now, Bishop Henning, and he's been, he's Dominican educated, he was at the Angelicum, and just seems like a really strong force for Catholic education. And so we're looking forward to having him here in the okay. diocese for years to come.
Yeah. And many of our families, you know, they're big, big fans of the Cardinal Newman Society mm-hmm. and the Newman Recommended Guide for Colleges. And we're fans at CLT of the Newman Guide, and they've been good longtime friends for us in the work that we're doing here. Providence College is not currently. At one time, I believe PC was on that list of recommended mm-hmm. colleges. And I try to tell families, you know, we love what the work the Cardinal Newman Society does, but there are there are colleges that are not listed that are still going to be really, really great options. I talk to families who go to Notre Dame and right. they have a great experience. Mm-hmm. You've got to be more thoughtful in navigating it for sure. But it sounds like for PC, very similar as well.
Yeah, it's absolutely. And that's, I try to be, the motto of the school is veritas, is truth. Hmm. I try to be as truthful and honest as I can. And, you know, you can get a robustly Catholic education here, but is it possible to get something else? Yes. And therefore, guides, like the Newman Guide is going to balk at that. So what I simply say to people, as Christ said, come and see. Come take a visit on campus. See what you see. See if it's for you.
Love that.
A lot of students will be, it's just funny, I'm smiling because I'm about to go have lunch with one of them afterwards, maybe late lunch, who came in, Catholic, New England Catholic family, born and raised in the faith, but by the time she's graduating high school, she's agnostic at best, comes here, and the very first thing she does is a program for pre-orientation where it's called FaithWorks. It's 50 students who, it's faith-based, it's campus ministry that runs it. You do ministry in the city, service to the poor, things like that. Every day starts with mass. You do sort of spiritual and theological reflection at the end of the days and what you're getting out of it. And by the end of her freshman year, she's in the chapel every night for holy hours. Mm. And she's like, do you have any books on grace? I want to learn more about grace.
Wow.
And so, she's now discerning religious life as well. So there's plenty of those. And then there are plenty of those who come in strongly Catholic, stay Catholic.
Yeah.
And there are those who have, major conversions.
I had this experience. I worked for 2 years at Mount DeSales Academy in Catonsville, Maryland, which is run by the Dominicans of Nashville, the Sisters. And, I always believed conceptually, sure, you could take a vow of poverty, chastity, and obedience and be happy. But when you actually see it, there's something that kind of spilled over in the life of the Dominicans at Mount DeSales. My daughters both go there now.
That's great.
And it's formative,
It is. And it's, I myself, I feel this calling to the priesthood and to religious life and the Dominicans, and I'm skeptical. I'm like, how can I be happy giving? You have to sacrifice a ton of natural goods. These are good things. But then you see, for me, it was going to the Dominican House of Studies in Washington, D.C., and meeting guys like who are now Father Gregory Pine, meeting Father Thomas Joseph White, and seeing this kind of joy that comes from surrendering your life to the Lord, living in close friendship with him every day by contemplative prayer in the presence of the Most Holy Eucharist. And it's like, actually, no, this can be and is sustaining. And I remember halfway through that first year, as you're a novice, as you're just trying the life out, I thought to myself, I could never leave. I'm the idea of not living under a roof that didn't, with a Blessed Sacrament wasn't there. I was like, I can't. Ooh, that's repulsive to me.
Now, some of our colleges, I think of a place like Thomas Aquinas or Christendom, Sam Phillips down at Christendom. I asked him one time, is Christendom a good place for non-Catholic students? And he said, I think we had one time, and then he became Catholic. But a place like the University of Dallas is pretty different. A lot of students, they come from classical Christian non-Catholic schools. They go to UD. They have a great experience there. Is PC also a place for non-Catholic believers as well? What is that?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And there's so many students that we have that fit that bill. And for anyone who's just interested in being well-rounded, being more fully human, who has a little bit, the background, especially in classical education or homeschooling, there's there's a place for you here. There are courses and topics and, you know, disciplines like through the humanities program that'll be both familiar, but also, you know, challenging, and they'll push you in terms of your intellectual growth. But you're also able to find, you know, a home where there's community and it's culturally, you know, renewing. And any student with a, you know, an open mind and like just a love for learning, you know, our faculty recognize that and they see that, and they'll give you special attention, and you find the reason that God brought you here. And so it, you know, there's a lot of mentoring, whether it's, you know, you see faculty members sitting in the cafeteria with students over lunch and just talking about what was in class and seeing where it goes. Okay. And it's, and so there's a lot of different ways that students from other traditions, yep, absolutely flourish here.
Academic majors of excellence at PC, if students want to go to med school, if they want to, what are some of the majors that draw students here? Especially, we've got a lot of high flyers in the CLT base, you know, students right. that are scoring a 110 on the CLT or awesome. 1480 on the SAT or something. What are some of the more compelling programs?
The most popular programs are through, the business school is really thriving. And that's a place where we have programs and ministries, like it's called Catholics in the Marketplace, where we have these luncheons with dialogues and things like that, and try to, okay, what does it mean for Catholics to, and just people of goodwill and good faith to operate in the business world. And that's about half our students are business majors. Other, you know, robust programs include psychology and neuroscience. We're just about to, we're beginning work to develop a school of a nursing program. And health sciences, you know, there's a deep need for that. And so the humanities program is involved with developing that.
So there is a nursing program.
So we're about to start. The first class is coming in the fall now.
Okay. Is that a direct admit, or do students apply once they get here to get into the nursing program?
It begins with a direct.
Okay.
Yep.
Oh, well, okay.
You can work your way into. And so those are the, again, when you see the price tag for a private Catholic education like this, and a lot of people think in a worldly way, when to start out, they begin in a worldly way. What career am I going to get out of this if I'm going to, you know, pay so much money for this education? Mm-hmm. Let you Google it. Am I going to say it? But then they get here and they discover other programs, even if they're not majors, then minors, like humanities or theology or philosophy.
Yeah.
And that complements and enhances the academic experience that they have.
Final question for you. We always conclude the Anchored podcast talking about great books, the books that have been most formative for our guests. Father, is there a book, Shakespeare and Lewis, that maybe that you reread that you just love teaching more than any others?
Gosh, yeah. We'll start with Lewis. And I think the most important book is The Abolition of Man that I keep going back to. But the one that I keep going back to and keep being renewed by is just The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. That's kind of the horror text, I think, for Lewis.
Yeah.
And precisely because it does such a good job, that the literary term for it is kind of defamiliarization, right? You know, the gospel can become so familiar, and with familiarity, you kind of lose that heart for it. You know, okay, I've heard this before. I know this story. But when you repackage it in the way that Lewis does so brilliantly, kind of never stop, at least for me, like there's always a tear that's shed, you know, on that, when Aslan is walking to make his sacrifice. There's a similar principle involved. People love The Chosen right now. And I think for a similar reason, right? It's defamiliarizing us from, and yet giving us the fullness of that same gospel text. So Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, I begin my introduction to literature courses with that, and just to kind of like baptize their imaginations and just resensitize them to ultimate truths. And that it's a great effect. Similarly for me, for Shakespeare, The Winter's Tale. So it's a late play of his, not as well known. You'd expect me to say Hamlet or something like that, but it is, think of Othello. There's this jealous king, except there's no Iago. It's kind of completely self-deceived, or he trips himself up thinking about his wife's infidelity. And it, for the first half of the play, you get this, like, it's like Othello in condensed form. It's going to this awful, tragic conclusion. And then through a lot of just miracles of grace and providence, and or you could say, you know, good fortune, all of a sudden you get comedy out of the grips of a tragedy. And it ends in a way that's, you know, kind of similar to Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. And there's beautiful parallels. And it's a play that I love to teach toward the end of a course, because it fills you with a sense of awe and wonder, and just, you know, a happy acceptance of things that are bigger than yourself, and the ability for forgiveness to happen and become part of something bigger.
As a scholar of both Shakespeare and C.S. Lewis, would you say that Shakespeare was one of the more influential authors and thinkers in C.S. Lewis's imagination?
I think so. Lewis, he astounds me. I wish, if there were anyone I could, any literary figure I could have a meal with, it would be him, or even over Shakespeare. I mean, he absorbed so much from so many different places, and it's hard to say where one influence begins and the other one ends. But Shakespeare certainly, suffused his imagination with, I think, the possibilities that come from like kind of moral transformation, okay. Choice, the effects of that choice, transformation through choices made in a way that, for instance, I'm thinking of contemporaries of Shakespeare. Like, I mean, Spencer was another big influence on Lewis, but it just doesn't, it doesn't register in the same way as Shakespeare does, I think, especially in his literary works.
Wow. Could pick your brain all day, Father. Again, we are here on campus at Providence College. Father Jordan, thank you for your ministry. Thank you for fighting for the orthodoxy and the future of this great college. We'd love to have you back on the program in the future.
Jeremy, it's been a great pleasure. Thank you for having me on. God bless.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Anchored. If you enjoyed it, please be sure to leave a rating or review on your podcast platform of choice. And remember to subscribe and share with your friends and colleagues. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next time.